the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast, where we discuss all things crypto related. Your host, Kieran Ryan.
The world's second largest crypto exchange, Bybit, was hit by a massive hack attack in February, where thieves from North Korea made off with around about $1.5 billion in Ethereum. Now, the hackers appear to have compromised a developer's laptop at Safe Wallet, which is Bybit's multi-signature wallet provider. They injected malicious code into the Safe user interface hosted on an Amazon server, masking what appeared to be a routine transfer as legitimate. This is alarming in its sophistication and has prompted all crypto exchanges in South Africa and no doubt around the world to review their online security. Well, one person who knows about crypto security and has helped numerous people track down stolen or lost crypto funds is Karel de Jager, research group leader at the CSIR and CEO of Silver Sixpence. Hi, Karel. It's good to speak to you again. This hack on Bybit, let's talk about that. It was quite terrifying in its audacity and has caused massive security concerns around the world. Maybe take us through your understanding. How did these North Korean hackers pull it off?
Thanks, Kieran. It's good to be back. So Ethereum doesn't have native multi-signature like Bitcoin, for example, has. So Ethereum uses multi-signature implemented through a series of smart contracts. So just as a reminder, let me just take a step back. Bitcoin is very, very simple in the way that the blockchain protocol operates. You can do basic things like transactions and create multi-signature transactions where more than one party needs to sign a transaction before it occurs and so on. But in Ethereum, that is not actually the case. It is a much, much more general computer system. You can do basically anything on it. So you can build your own multi-signature smart contracts as part of the protocol. And that is just a computer that lives on top of the Ethereum blockchain and executes according to the code that you've published on top of that blockchain. So that's just a bit of a backdrop. Now, this attack by the North Koreans was incredibly sophisticated. I've never seen a sophisticated attack on this level. It is absolutely out of this world, to be honest, the way that they've done this. And they have compromised a developer machine, like you rightfully said there in the introduction, of a developer that works for this company that employs or creates multi-signature smart contracts. They are called Safe or Gnosis Safe in some instances. And the way that they did it was probably through a very, very sophisticated phishing or social engineering attack. They got control of a front-end developer's laptop, which in some instances, I think front-end developers go through less security scrutinization than, for instance, back-end developers or the database developers, for example. So they somehow infiltrated this laptop and then injected a very, very small bit of code, into the front-end or into the user interface of an application that Gnosis Safe customers used to access the multi-signature smart contracts. So in many cases, you have a basic web interface, like a website, for example, or a program that you download from the internet onto your desktop. But in this case, it was a web application. So in a lot of cases, you just go through a web application in order to access these smart contracts, because accessing a smart contract directly is very, very technical. It's not really feasible in order to do that. So you usually go through a website. If you think about Uniswap, for example, which is a decentralized exchange, it also consists of a series of smart contracts, but there's a website on top of it that actually just processes your actions and feeds that to the smart contract. Now, that's the part that was infiltrated. That's the part that was hacked. And a very small piece of that was changed so that it looked like the funds went from one wallet from wallet A to wallet B, but in fact it went to wallet C. So just that wallet B or that address was changed so that it looked like that. Now here's the thing, is that there's always a last line of defense when you sign with a hardware wallet. So to explain that, for example, if you use a hardware wallet, let's say you use a Ledger Nano, for example, which is a very popular hardware wallet, there's a little screen on these hardware wallets. that you should always look at that screen, and then you'll see, okay, so this is the destination of the funds. And that's your last line of defense. So you try not to trust anything up until that screen, because that screen is really trustless. It's super secure. Like, you cannot really hack that little screen or the message that's displayed on that screen. And now that works pretty well for Bitcoin, but it doesn't work well for Ethereum smart contract calls, which is now a little bit technical. But the thing is that a smart contract message, before it is published to the blockchain, is usually hashed. So that screen, which makes that little message on the screen meaningless, can't really do that. So that's a shortcoming of the Ethereum protocol and the way the transactions are signed. Just a little bit more about the insides of this hack is that it was a multi-signature. I think it was a 3 out of 5 multi-signature. So 3 people had to sign this transaction before it happened. 3 people. All three of them were incorrectly signed the transaction and basically approved the funds to move to this wallet which wasn't intended. And it is the largest financial hack, to be honest, of all time. Not even cryptocurrency, it's the largest financial hack, as far as I understand, of all time at $1.5 billion.
Now, what impact has the Bybit attack had on crypto operators around the world? I imagine everybody is looking very closely at their security, because this is, you've just outlined the sophistication of this attack. And from my understanding, they took many months cultivating and gaining a degree of online trust with this person who was employed by Safe. What do you think is happening? And I guess you're probably having to advise people on how they can upgrade their security.
So we've seen very limited statements from all of the existing exchanges about it, but all of them have made some, you know, broad statement about the security measures after this hack. I know there are some Luno and Valor, and I think Altcoin Trader as well, in terms of the South African context, saying that that they've reviewed their security practices. I think one of the articles was actually on MoneyWeb as well, where publishing these statements by all of these South African exchanges. And some of them mentioning that they don't necessarily use Safe. But one thing that I have to say is that the level of sophistication of this attack is so incredibly advanced that it would not have naturally shown up in any threat modeling. Now, threat modeling is usually something that an exchange or any cybersecurity sensitive firm would go through, and they would think, okay, what can go wrong? It's like a risk assessment, right? What can go wrong, and are we covering for all of the for all of the things that can go wrong in future? But because of the sophistication of this hack, and it's never ever happened in the history of crypto, or I think, you know, maybe even broader than that, it would not have shown up in threat detections. And there is no way that this could have actually been prevented, in my opinion, other than going through it and doing a proper post-mortem and then taking reactive steps in order to correct it. And that's what makes it so scary. You know, I've seen some in the past, I've seen some pretty scary stuff on exchanges. If you go, for instance, into the blockchain, and you look at some of the cold wallets or some of these exchanges, you can go to Binance, for example, today, and you can go and look at their gold wallets, and you can go and look at some of their spend history, and you will see that at some point they had hundreds of thousands of Bitcoin in a single signature wallet, which means that only one person is required to authorize that transaction and for it to be spent on the blockchain. So some of these things that we see on exchanges is incredibly scary, and that is a result of not having standards. We have some best practices regarding custody of crypto assets, but we don't have proper standards coming from a regulatory backdrop that's enforced on crypto custodians, for example. That's also the reason why we don't have insurance on crypto exchanges. Like, if you are the victim of a hack like this in Bybit, and luckily I have to also commend Bybit on this, is they were over-collateralized on all their liabilities, which means that they could actually recover from this hack without too much damage and without any one of their customers taking a haircut. So big up to them for being able to do that. But the fact of the matter is, if there were a haircut or if Bybit was forced to liquidation of their assets, then the users of Bybit Exchange would not have been insured, and they would have stood at the back of the line to get some cents on the dollar that they've invested. And we've seen that with FTX. We've seen that with in South Africa, IceCube. We've seen that with Cryptopia, that New Zealand exchange. We've seen that so many times, over and over and over again, that these exchanges get infiltrated, they get hacked in some way or shape. And then, unfortunately, it's their clients that are on the shortest end of that.
You mentioned there that this was the multi-signature, which is before any transaction is made on an exchange, you would have to have three or five people, and sometimes it's two out of three people, signing off on a transaction. There has been some discussion about this that maybe there's a little bit of laziness. In other words, it came down to a human element. The first signer said, this looks okay to me. And the other two, they've trusted this guy before. So they said, yeah, well, okay, you know, we'll just tick that box and we'll let the transaction go through. Is there any truth in that, in your opinion?
I don't think that can really be proved, at least on a technical level, by looking at the blockchain transactions and so on. But I've seen that behavior. You know, that's quite a common thing. I mean, we find it in every sphere of corporate life. If you're the second signatory on a document, I mean, then you know you're definitely inclined to pay less attention to actually reading the document before you sign, because you actually, you know, just going on the back of someone else's opinion, for example. So that's definitely very normal behavior, and I wouldn't be surprised if that was the case.
And maybe it's a question we need to start asking about exchanges, is the level of collateralization they have. You did point out that Bybit was over-collateralized. They were able to make everybody whole very quickly, I think within 24 hours. Is this a question that we should be asking of exchanges?
Oh, for sure. And I'm a big, big, big proponent of proof of reserves. In fact, I was a part of the team in 2022 that did proof of reserves on Binance and KuCoin and Crypto.com just after the FTX hack. And I've also worked with Coinbase extensively on a development grant to develop zero-knowledge proof of reserve software for Coinbase. And currently, we're in discussions to actually start implementing that. So I'm a massive, massive proponent of proof of reserves. Now, proof of reserves is an accounting method that exchanges or custodians of cryptocurrencies can use to prove that they have the assets that they claim that they have on chain, that they have access to that, but also, very importantly, to prove that their liabilities that they actually owe to clients are less than the amount of assets that they own on chain. Now, this is a very cheap procedure to implement. There's no reason for exchanges not to do it. We've seen that the regulator is also realizing this. So we've seen it being mandated in several jurisdictions around the world. I think most notably is the state of Texas. And there's currently a bill on federal level in the US as well. We've seen states, jurisdictions like Bermuda and Canada being big proponents of this. And even our own regulators here in South Africa starting to investigate the benefits of proof of reserves mandates. And I'm a big proponent. I think every exchange should do it. I think that users of exchanges should be extremely wary to use an exchange that does not have frequent proof of reserve publications from a technical, like in a technically sound way. Like, proof of reserves is one thing, but it should also be technically sound. And if you don't know how to determine technically soundness of a proof of reserves implementation, then there's some tools online, or you can contact me and I can give you an opinion and so on. But I do think that proof of reserves is an absolute minimum requirement to use an exchange. Now, if we look at Bybit, for example, in this hack, we can see some of the benefits of that, because Bybit's proof of reserves showed that they were about $1.5 billion over collateralized on their liabilities. And everyone knew that. And these were like additional assets that they've built up over time because of whatever means, operational means that they make revenue with. And they've showed that on chain. And then they were hacked for about $1.5 billion, which means that all of their excess assets are now evaporated. That's sad, yes. But the good thing is that they were able to continue operations and not even halt withdrawals. Everything were continuing as normal, even though there was a massive run on the bank from Bybit customers. They were able to satisfy all the withdrawal requests that they received. And it was because everyone knew, and there was no mass panic, because everyone knew that they were over-collateralized. Now, if that happened to an exchange like Coinbase, for example, which does not publish periodic proof of reserves, or one of the other exchanges, maybe I shouldn't single out any single one, but which does not publish, then there would have been mass panic. And who knows what would have happened, if that run of the bank was an order of magnitude higher on an exchange that was hacked. I mean, then very, very bad prospects you could have realized.
It is a strange coincidence that the amount stolen was $1.5 billion in Ethereum and stacked ETH, which is exactly more or less the amount of over-collateralization. Does that not point the finger at maybe an inside job?
I doubt it. I see where you are coming from. But if we look at on-chain analysis, for example, we have a clear indication that this was the results of actions from the Lazarus group, a North Korean hacker group. They've also started to employ some very sophisticated online anonymization techniques, for example, and laundering these funds and so on. So that's quite interesting to keep an eye on as well. And I think also based on the reaction of Bybit, the way that their executive team, their CEO and the CTO just went on Twitter and didn't sleep for how many days and did a lot of live video feed and Q&A sessions with the community and so on, just to set everyone at ease and assist them. I think that, I don't know, so maybe to me, there's nothing pointing out to be an inside job. It's perhaps possible. I don't know if those assets were rightfully belonged to the shareholders of Bybit in any case or not. I'm not an expert on that. But there's a chance that it would have been the assets of the shareholders in any case, payable through dividends and accessing that through a hack might not have even been the optimal way to do it.
You were involved in the development of ExoChain at the CSIR. That's a tool for tracking down funds that have been scammed or lost using the blockchain. I understand you made some good progress in putting this into the service of law enforcement in South Africa. Recently spoke to Gerard van Deventer from the Financial Sector Conduct Authority, and he mentioned this this facility that you offered to him and to his organization. Tell us a bit about that and what kind of progress you've made.
Yeah, so the thing is that, as you rightfully mentioned there, the blockchain is 100% transparent, and anyone can go and look at the transactions and just use a block explorer, for example, and trace and track these transactions, and you can get a huge amount of intelligence from the blockchain and from the data that's published on this transparent ledger. But the thing is that the intelligence is not very useful. You need to push it through a data processing engine that would then take this data and process it in a way that it becomes useful, and that the way that investigations, for example, can be done. Now, there are services that do this, but they're all based in the global west and the global north, and they're very, very expensive. In fact, they're so expensive that South African companies can usually not afford them, and even our law enforcement departments cannot really afford the subscriptions that some of these companies charge. Because blockchain data is worth gold, I can guarantee you that it prices data. So we set out at the CSIR. I mean, the CSIR being a public entity, CSIR. Part of our mandate is to increase the capability of the state. So we set out in order to localize these solutions and build South African product that would be affordable, that would be good, that would be focused on the South African market, for example, as well. You know, have special capabilities that serve our South African regulators, for example, well. And that's what we set out to do. It's still in a proof of concept, or in a, actually maybe in a minimal viable product state. I mean, it is a huge, huge engineering challenge to do this, to be honest. It's a massive engineering challenge to build a product that does as sophisticated data processing as that. And as you can imagine, it's massive data. We're talking thousands of transactions happening every second over the most prominent blockchain networks around the world. And you need to take all of that and crunch the numbers and then produce actionable reports. So that's where we are. And we started engaging with the FSCA. Like Gerard there mentioned, is we recently used a tool to assist them with one of the investigations. I don't want to say too much. I don't know how much I'm allowed to say about who investigated and all of those kind of things, but it was relatively successful, yeah.
Just on that point, the hackers from North Korea, the Lazarus Group, the blockchain itself consists of a whole lot of addresses, but there are no names attached to those addresses. But because of KYC, Know Your Customer, all the exchanges implement this now, so you are able to attach a name. But you did mention that part of the sophistication of this hack was that the North Koreans were able to then very quickly move these funds through anonymous addresses. They maybe use mixers, which is a way of sort of disguising the origins of funds. Is there any possibility, do you think, of recovering some of this money?
Yeah, so laundering money is possible on the blockchain, even though the ledger is very, very transparent. There's certain centralized services so that will assist you to launder this money and so on. And there's certain techniques that you can employ. And I find this very, very interesting. So I've been looking at this very closely and the techniques that the Lazarus Group used. Of course, $1.5 billion is not that easy because you need liquidity. You need someone else to actually take custody of your dirty assets, and which is now tainted and so on. So it takes some special techniques. As far as I could gather, they've laundered about half of it now, or anonymized about half of it. I won't say completely anonymized because that's impossible, but they've really made it extremely difficult to track these wallets. And they've used a number of techniques. First, they spread it over tens of thousands of different addresses in the wallets. So now you cannot just track one. You need to track tens of thousands. And then they've used a series of exchanges. So some of it, they pushed through some of these CoinJoin and Tornado Cash launderers, Tumblr as well, to anonymize some of it, but there's only so much liquidity available there. They've used a service called EXCH. I don't know how to pronounce that, EXCH. They've used, I think it's a centralized exchange, but they don't collect KYC data, for example. So you can go in, you can deposit your assets, you can do some basic trading, and you can withdraw again, and then it's clean. So they've used some of that. They've also just exchanged their tokens from STETH, Stake ETH, and some of the other tokens that they've started to native ETH. Because a lot of these tokens are subject to normal sanctioning rules. So Stake ETH, for example, there's a centralized entity that is able to freeze an account if you have if there's sufficient proof that you've not adhered to global regulations, for example, then they can freeze those accounts. Same with USDT, same with USDC, and so on. So all of these tokens that they had, they first swapped them into native Ethereum because native ETH is censorship resistant, and you can transact freely with that, only subject to the blockchain protocol itself. So that's basically what happened. So we're keeping a close eye on it. I mean, the thing is also, you must also remember, and I think that's maybe part of the catch here, is that even though they're employing sophisticated methods which make it difficult to trace those funds now, these transactions will be on the blockchain forever. And maybe it's difficult to trace them now because we don't have the necessary tools and software to do that. That might not be the case in 5 years or 10 years from now. So anyone that's trying to, you know, launder money through the blockchain and thinking you're getting away with it now, it might be the case. But remember, This is not subject to South African law where documents are destroyed after 5 years or your bank statements aren't available after a certain amount of time. This blockchain will be available and readable in 100 years from now. And it will never be deleted. It is not subject to the POPI Act or to GDPR or anything like that. So be careful with what you do on the blockchain. Always make sure you act in an ethical way.
Indeed. All right. Now, given the security concerns around crypto we've been talking about, and we discussed this before, should people look into self-custody, these tools like Ledger, and so on, or should they continue to leave the crypto that they own on the exchanges? There's a debate on both sides. What is your latest view on that?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I'm also very centered to that debate. I'm not always sure whether I'm on the one side or the other. I think it's everyone needs a unique approach, and you need to evaluate your risk appetite. Like, for instance, let me put it this way: if you're trading and using small money, money that won't change your life materially if you lose it, then it's fine, leave it on exchange. I mean, the risks of moving it to your own wallet or self-custody is just too high because it's technically complex to do that. And there's a big chance that you might get that wrong. If you don't do proper inheritance planning, for example, and you pass on, then your crypto probably dies with you, unfortunately. And if you didn't do proper inheritance planning. So, I mean, there's a balance to be struck. If it's life-changing money, then of course you need to get it off from the exchange because an exchange is subject to attacks like we've seen now with Bybit. Now, I'm seeing, luckily, more and more people actually starting to offer this as a service, people and companies. And I would really like to get the banks involved, to be honest, because, I mean, the banks are a bit slow. The banks need to get involved in this in this stuff because that's where we usually went to when we required help, you know, securing our finances and so on. And the banks are experts at this. So I would like to actually urge the banks to get involved because people are losing their life savings left, right, and center, whether that is leaving it on an exchange, whether that is trying to put it on a hardware wallet and do self-custody. So we need more experts, we need more people that we can trust, and we need corporations to actually assist people doing this. And not only people, but even institutions. I mean, we have so many institutions in South Africa that wants to get exposure to this asset class, but they don't know how to do the custody. They don't know how to do the acquisition or the disposal of the assets. These things are just too technically complex for them to understand, and they don't have the time to educate themselves on this. So they would like to outsource this to a professional, but the problem is there aren't none. There aren't any in South Africa. There's very, very few. I can name you a couple, but there's way, way too few to actually serve all of the demand.
Final question, Carl. What can you tell us about another subject we spoke about before, and that is the possibility of Eskom getting into Bitcoin mining?
Yeah, I actually did a presentation which is available online in January about Eskom, about the numbers, and it's quite fascinating about the numbers of what Eskom could have earned if they started mining Bitcoin about 5 years ago. And just to summarize it, Eskom would have been debt-free if they did that with only surplus power. And they would have had another about 400 billion rand in capital. And South Africa might have been on a double-digit growth path if they did that, right? So it's actually astounding. If you look at the numbers, if Eskom just used a portion of their surplus power to mine Bitcoin, they would have been debt-free. So a very small portion, that is. And even after all of the load shedding and all of the problems that we've experienced in the last 5 years, that's even after that. So, I mean, yeah, so we've been in discussions. I can't say too much, but I think Eskom is really realizing what benefits Bitcoin mining can bring to the national electricity grid in terms of stabilization, in terms of revenue production, in terms of actually monetizing surplus or wasted energy. So those discussions are ongoing. And there's some real momentum behind it, so I'm feeling quite good about it.
Lovely discussion. Thank you very much, Carol Diacha, who is research group leader at the CSIR, and he is CEO of a company called Silver Sixpence. What a cool name.
Thanks for listening to the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast, hosted by Kieran Ryan. To listen to our other podcasts, go to moneyweb.co.za or the MoneyWeb app and follow MoneyWeb News for daily updates.